U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement recently completed a five-week operation targeting transnational criminal gangs. The operation netted more than 1,100 arrests across the country, more than 700 of them along the U.S.-Mexico border. I'm Shelley Koffler, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. The question of how to stop transnational gang violence is at the heart of a debate over security. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider takes a look at the money that's being spent.
The Subcommittee on National Security and the Subcommittee on Government Operations will come to order.
The latest congressional hearing on border security took place just one day after the Brussels bombings. Much of the testimony dealt with the potential for travelers from as far afield as Pakistan and Somalia to slip into the United States from Mexico to stage such attacks here. But it also focused on a threat based much closer to home. Brandon Judd is president of the National Border Patrol Council, the union representing U.S. Border Patrol agents.
It is well documented that criminal cartels control the border in the same way inmates control most prison facilities. The cartels are extremely well organized, pathologically violent, and have an entire infrastructure on both sides of the border.
By law, the federal government, specifically the Border Patrol, has jurisdiction over security on the U.S.-Mexico border. But the belief that it's not doing enough has led Texas to take measures of its own. Stephen McCraw is director of the Texas Department of Public Safety.
Every day, we deploy Texas State Troopers, Texas Rangers, and special agents from the Department of Public Safety from around the state down to the Rio Grande Valley, where right now is the epicenter of drug and human smuggling into the United States, and we'll continue to do so, as has been our direction, until the border is secure.
The Texas National Guard and state game wardens are also part of the effort. McCraw says all this is necessary because the Border Patrol lacks the means to do the job alone.
If properly resourced, they have the leadership and the type of people that can get the job done to secure the Texas-Mexico border, and that's important.
It's far from clear, though, that resources are the problem. The U.S. now spends roughly $19 billion a year on border security, an increase of more than 300% since 2002. Doris Meissner led the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service under President Clinton. She's now a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute.
We're, as a country, committing the same amount of money to border enforcement, principally the Southwest border, as we are to all other federal criminal law enforcement agencies combined.
To supplement the federal effort, Texas is set to spend roughly $800 million on border security in the current two-year budget cycle, which ends August 31st of next year. That's nearly a third of the budget for Texas DPS. Resources devoted to watching the border aren't available for other DPS functions, like highway safety or emergency management.
I think the focus on border security is a bit misguided.
Stephen Zamora heads the Center for U.S. and Mexican Law at the University of Houston Law Center. He says that strengthening the border is clearly important, but he says it's not nearly as important as strengthening the rule of law in Mexico itself.
We could build the greatest wall ever built since the Great Wall of China, and it still wouldn't deal with insecurity that we would have if Mexico itself is not secure and stable.
The U.S. has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on aid to Mexico over the past decade to help battle organized crime. Much of that funding has gone to purchase military-grade hardware. Far less has gone to fight corruption in the country's law enforcement and courts. Zamora says until the U.S. cuts the demand for illegal drugs north of the border, the money to pay for that corruption will continue to flow south. I'm Andrew Schneider.
Emergency care on the border can be crucial for immigrants traveling to the United States. In California, when 911 is dialed in San Diego County, the first responder is usually a paramedic or an emergency medical technician, an EMT. Tom Fudge of KPBS talked with reporter Leo Castaneda about advanced EMTs and how they're saving lives in rural border areas.
I'm looking at the number of emergency medical personnel with active licenses in California. There are more than 80,000, mostly EMTs and paramedics. That's a huge number, but if we dive down a bit deeper, there's a third group, advanced EMTs. There are only about 100 of them in the whole state.
Advanced EMTs, never heard of them.
Neither had I before this, Tom. Turns out, advanced EMTs can do things regular EMTs can't, like administer some emergency medication for allergic reactions or diabetes. Most counties in the state prefer paramedics, but some rural counties might have trouble hiring and keeping paramedics. For them, advanced EMTs are the next best option. But here's a strange thing. Almost 1 in 5 advanced EMTs in the state are right here in San Diego.
Well, San Diego isn't exactly rural, so what's going on?
It mostly comes down to, of all people, the Border Patrol. They employ 14 agents with advanced EMT licenses as part of the Border Patrol Search, Trauma, and Rescue Unit, BORSTAR for short. Advanced EMTs can actually provide someone with an IV. That's important because agents often find migrants and stranded hikers out in the desert and mountains suffering from dehydration. And those agents have been busy. Last fiscal year, the BORSTAR team rescued more than 100 people.
So all these advanced EMTs, are they good news for San Diego?
Well, they can do a lot, but if I had an emergency and I could choose, I'd go with a paramedic. There's a much broader range of treatments and medicines they can administer.
That was Tom Fudge of KPBS talking with reporter Leo Castaneda. Now to New Mexico, where there's a new program to help people who frequently call 911. Many are homeless or have behavioral health problems because good medical care isn't available. Turning to emergency health care can be both expensive and ineffective. KUNM's Ed Williams reports on how Santa Fe is trying a new approach to answering those calls.
Hey, Carol.
Hi, you.
How have you been?
I'm Ty.
Sorry to
Roland Jones is a firefighter and EMT with the Santa Fe City Fire Department. He's on duty, visiting the home of Carol Garcia and her husband, Joaquin, but there's no emergency here. Not today.
How's the Seroquel been?
The Seroquel?
Is it helping you sleep
puts
good?
Puts me to sleep.
Good.
Jones has responded to scores of 911 calls at Garcia's house over the years. Her severe schizophrenia makes her prone to outbursts of anger, and her husband would call emergency dispatch for help, even though it wasn't necessarily an emergency.
We gotta get consistent, you know. We have to find a nice balance that works for you to where you feel good and you're happy. And
yeah.
Garcia recently switched doctors, and Jones is worried she'll miss her next round of medication. For someone in her condition, that could mean a run-in with the police or a trip to the psychiatric hospital, things that could do more harm than good.
Do you want to still get the shot tomorrow at this one?
No, I don't. I don't trust her. I don't trust any of them.
What if I maybe went in with you?
Jones took on Garcia's case as part of the Mobile Integrated Health Office, a new program at the fire department that's trying to get help to frequent 911 callers before they have a real emergency. The mobile health team figures out what kind of help each patient needs, whether it's a ride to the clinic or repairs to the stairs in an apartment where an elderly patient can fall down. Jones usually spends his time with Garcia, smoothing out doctor visits, talking about counseling options, even having picnics in the park.
That was nice.
I think that's helped Carol a lot, you know, to get out.
Garcia and her husband Joaquin say those efforts have made things a lot easier for them. And it turns out there's a lot of people in the same kind of situation. People like Garcia make up less than 1% of Santa Fe's population, but account for 15% of the city's 911 calls. Those non-emergency 911 calls cost a lot of money. They can have real consequences for emergency responders, too. Andres Mercado, who runs the Mobile Integrated Health Program, remembers one instance that stuck in his mind.
We were transporting an intoxicated individual who we knew very well. We transported him many times in the past, and a structure fire came in on Palace Avenue, and we were the first to ambulance to the fire, and we weren't able to go.
This kind of interference in emergency response services happened almost 4,000 times in 2014 alone. Mercado says what was maybe even more frustrating was the fact that the people calling 911 weren't getting the help they needed from EMS visits.
These are people who have a really hard time navigating the healthcare system, and who have some complicated issues and some very complicated life stories sometimes.
Right now, the mobile health program is focusing on the 20 Santa Fe residents who call 911 most frequently, people the program calls high utilizers, and trying to get those people the help they need to get back on their feet again. In a few months, they'll reach out to another group of frequent callers.
It is a matter of life and death. And we don't see a lot of high utilizers over the age of 55 because they're dead.
That's Kristen Carmichael, a social worker with Christus St. Vincent Regional Medical Center, who advises the firefighters in the mobile health program. She says even though Santa Fe's most frequent 911 callers are the most vulnerable people in the city, they're also a group that shows a lot of promise.
These folks are incredibly resilient, and with the right kind of approach, they can make incredible gains.
And it does look like some impressive gains have been made. Over the couple of months the program has been up and running, the average number of monthly emergency calls from the people the team's been working with has dropped 85%. Now, fire and EMS departments in Albuquerque and elsewhere are looking to see if the mobile health model could work for them too. Reporting from Santa Fe, I'm Ed Williams.
Now for solutions from healthcare to solutions for learning, we go to San Diego. Students there recently collaborated with Mexico City High School students on videos about media violence. Jean Guerrero of KPBS reports the goal is to have students learn from each other by working on global problems.
On a recent Friday at the San Diego Museum of Contemporary Art, high schoolers from both sides of the border watched videos they'd made together. Bridget Brightfield of Encinitas had helped to make one that symbolically explored domestic violence. The students gave feedback in both languages.
Tú, cuando te dieron la actividad, ¿qué pasó realmente?
There was like a language barrier at first, but there's a couple of them that are bilingual. I'm not. But yeah, the bilingual kids help us and stuff.
The museum education curators say they want the Mexican and American students to learn from each other, specifically in terms of how to solve global problems, and to learn to be open-minded. Elena Villa-Cardona is one of the students visiting from Mexico City. She says the collaboration helped her learn that the U.S. suffers from violence too, not just Mexico.
There is still racial violence in the streets. For example, the first night we came in, we were walking down the street and there was a couple of people that start shouting at us, English only.
She says she's eager to spread a positive message about Mexico through art.
Well, Mexico is one of the countries with a lot of problems in the world. However, we wanted to show that we are not just watching far away. We want to do something about it. There's a time at night that it's dangerous to go out. I mean, that violence is daily life, and I don't want to see that we just are used to it. I want to change it.
The students collaborated on videos for months ahead of meeting.
We were here in the U.S., but they were in Mexico City, so we had to kind of take videos and then send them, and then they would send us stuff, and, oh, what do you think about this?
Karina Hernandez goes to Chula Vista High School. Her binational team made a video that symbolically explored war and terrorism.
Kind of like a really healthy way of dealing with issues that otherwise it would be very difficult to approach, you know?
She says she found a lot of similarities between the challenges that she and Mexican students face.
It's kind of funny how we can be so alike, even though we're from very different places.
She says as a child of immigrants who left Mexico, she grew up thinking the country's challenges were somewhat insurmountable. But she says her Mexico City counterparts are showing her that's not the case.
Not everybody's passive. People my age especially are very hands-on. They're very, they have ambitions, they have dreams, and they're willing to get them, to work for them.
She says she feels a greater appreciation for her Mexican roots than before. For Fronteras, I'm Jean Guerrero.
Coming up on Fronteras, the latest on tornado survivor Lindsay Diaz, whose home was mistakenly torn down. Her story's making headlines in other countries.
You know, I've had people reach out to me from the UK, you know, asking me for my story.
That story and a special citizenship ceremony for children after this. I'm Shelley Koffler, and this is Fronteras. Democrats and civil libertarians are applauding a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling on a Texas case that challenged the way voting districts are drawn. The decision in Evanwell versus Abbott may bolster the growing influence of Latino voters. 2 years ago, Sue Evanwell, a resident of Titus County, challenged the way the state of Texas draws legislative voting districts, which are created with a nearly equal number of residents. Evanwell claimed districts should instead be drawn with an equal number of eligible voters. In an unusual unanimous vote, justices rejected Evanwell's argument and preserved the principle of one person, one vote, which has been a legal test since 1964. Texas Democrat Democratic Party spokesman Emmanuel Garcia says the decision is important in making sure everyone has representation, including immigrants, minors, and others who don't vote.
We believe that every single person should have a voice in their government, and that our elected official should be responsive to everyone's needs, not just those that can put them into power.
Plaintiffs who lost the case say the issue of voting equality isn't going away. Ilya Shapiro is an attorney with the Libertarian Cato Institute, which filed a brief in support of Evanwell. He believes the justices got it wrong.
It's not fair and violates the constitutional principle of one person, one vote, to have significantly different numbers of voters in different districts. If you have 100 voters in one district and 200 in another, well, that district where there's only 100, each of their votes is worth twice as much.
Legal experts say a ruling in favor of Evanwell would have shifted political influence away from Democratic urban areas to more Republican rural areas and would have damaged political influence in the Latino community, where some members haven't registered to vote or don't qualify to vote because of immigration status. Now we have more news on the young mother whose tornado-damaged home was demolished by mistake 2 weeks ago. For Lindsay Diaz of Rowlett in North Texas, the days since have been a haze of meetings with insurance adjusters, phone calls with her builder, and media requests from across the country and around the world. The demolition company has promised to make things right. KERA's Courtney Collins reports Diaz just wants her life to get back to normal.
In just 3 months, her Rowlett duplex went from happy home to storm-wrecked house to concrete slab. And Lindsay Diaz says she's not sure how much more she can take.
You know, I just couldn't believe, like, what else could happen to me? You know, I just hope that this is it.
Diaz bundles her 9-month-old, Adian, into a stroller and checks out what's left of the duplex.
They didn't pull up all of the floor, so I'm able to recognize that that's my bathroom because the tile's still there.
It's just the foundation, with little patches of flooring here and there, and even that can't be salvaged.
So the foundation needs to come up. We will not be able to build a house on it, so it's going to have to be taken up.
2 weeks ago, a crew from Billy Neighbors Demolition tore down this duplex by mistake. They were supposed to demolish a house one block over. They had the right number, but the wrong street. A spokesperson with the company told Diaz they will make things right.
The impression I have is that they're going to build what they took down. You know, because the home was already damaged, and I did receive funds from my insurance company. My impression is they're going to pay the difference.
An employee with Billy Neighbors Demolition sent over a statement. It reads in part, quote, "We understand the significance of our mistake, and we have taken the necessary steps to address the loss to the homeowners. This was an unfortunate and unintentional accident caused by human error and nothing else."
I don't even know what to feel anymore. It's just, it's a lot of emotions.
And perhaps even more attention. Ever since her home was knocked down, Diaz has been pelted with interview requests nonstop.
A home demolished by mistake. That's the strange reality in Rowlett tonight.
An engineer declared the home structurally sound, but then it was mistakenly torn down.
But what if the house you were trying to repair got demolished by mistake?
Instant notoriety was not something she expected.
You know, I've had people reach out to me from the UK, you know, asking me for my story.
And while the media attention has been interesting and some people have materialized out of thin air asking how they could help, Diaz says she'd rather wind back the clock to the morning of December 26, 2015, when she still lived in a cozy two-bedroom duplex with her boyfriend and baby.
It's so much. And I work full time. You know, I have the baby and I'm just, it's starting to get to me.
The tornado hit almost 3.5 months ago, and she's no closer to rebuilding her life than she was the day after the storm. And while she hopes everything will work out in the end, Lindsay Diaz says she'd really just like a stretch of smooth pavement on her road to recovery. For Fronteras, I'm Courtney Collins.
You know, growing up in the United States includes many milestones, from school plays to graduations. But a group of 49 kids celebrated something especially unique in San Diego recently. They became American citizens. Matt Bowler of KPBS witnessed the special ceremony.
Proud families of 49 children. The kids in their Sunday best and their newly awarded certificates in hand. This is Ojin Lazar.
I play soccer a lot, so I want to become a soccer player.
That's his dream, but he also wants to join the military.
Looking forward to helping other people.
12-year-old Ojin and all the other children sit as if at a school assembly, but this ceremony is different.
You will help build our future.
Deborah Zekely is the co-founder of the New Americans Museum, and she helped organize today's event. These kids from 13 different countries, as young as 4, are all taking their citizenship oath, becoming American citizens. Zekely says when children become citizens, they don't usually get any fanfare.
They become a citizen anyhow, but it just comes in an envelope.
Not today. There was plenty of fanfare. Politicians gave speeches.
On behalf of the House of Representatives.
Ojin was 5 when he moved to El Cajon from Iraq.
Remember it was dangerous there? And scary a little.
Yeah.
We were really excited when we got to move.
And now.
It's a great thing to become a citizen.
And so when they're 20 and 30, if someone mentions citizenship, I would hope there'll be a flashback and they'll remember this day.
That was Matt Bowler of KPBS reporting. And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Taronga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Shelley Koffler with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.